Good evening. I am Scott Sinclair, and as some of you have experienced, I am a member of the Dominican faculty. The talk I am about to give is one of a series of lectures sponsored by the Big History Program and by Campus Ministry and the Division of Humanities, Religion, and Philosophy. The goal of this series is to deal with the intersection of big history with religion and ethics. As you can see, the title of my talk is The Evolution of Love, Religion, and Science, a brief history, a little history of a big topic. In big history courses, students often have to write a treatment of how some specific thing evolved over the huge time span of big history. So if your topic is chewing gum, you begin by the formation of the hydrogen atoms in chewing gum shortly after the Big Bang. Then you would go on to how the carbon atoms in chewing gum were formed in the cores of large stars. Eventually, after billions of years, you would get to the human invention of chewing gum, and the paper would end with prospects for the future of chewing gum. Since my assignment is to talk about the intersection of religion, ethics, and big history, I will do a similar survey. We'll be dealing with how did love, how did religion, how did science originate in the time scale of big history? How did these three things evolve? How have they related to each other during that time frame? And what are the prospects for the future? We begin then with love. These days, we use the word love very loosely. You can even say you love Thursdays because they serve ice cream in the dining hall. But here I'm going to be using love more narrowly. As you can see from the slide, I'm going to argue that love involves both positive concern and concrete actions as an expression of that concern. Thus, I would argue that actions which may help you a great deal, but are not motivated by positive concern for you, should not be seen as illustrations of love. If you desperately need a large loan, and the bank gives it to you, but at a high interest rate, with the hope of making a large profit for itself, we would not say that the loan is an expression of the bank's concern about you. Similarly, an inner concern which never manifests itself in appropriate concrete actions should not be considered as love. If a father says, "I love my children, but I never pay child support and I never talk to them," we would question the honesty of that statement. Okay. Now, from an evolutionary perspective, love evolved with the helplessness of infants in certain species. Now, there are many species in which there is very little contact after mating. The mating itself is brief. And after that, the children are abandoned to themselves. So I never happen to have seen toads mate, but I assume they must. And they do lay eggs, but the eggs hatch into tadpoles or something or other. And I do not think the frog, the toad, whatever, shows a great deal of love for the children. In the course of evolution, however, newborns in some species, especially in birds, and in our own branch of living things in mammals, became helpless for long periods of time. They were totally dependent for food and many other kinds of nurture from parents. Sometimes the needs of the young were so great that the mother could not provide sufficient care by herself, and so both the mother and the father had to cooperate in raising the offspring. It is clear that in these situations, the parents at least act lovingly. Their actions of feeding, stroking, and so forth clearly are helpful to the newborns. And it's reasonable to suppose that in these species, there is also some inner affection, something we might reasonably call the feeling of love. Now, it would probably be a mistake to say that one thing caused the other, that first infants became helpless and then love evolved, or that first parents loved offspring and then the offspring became helpless. It seems much more realistic to say these things gradually evolve together. Love and helplessness in infants slowly came to be greater and greater. Now, since I'm assured that all of you are penguins, this slide should remind you of your own childhood and how, when you were helpless, your mother and father penguins had an inner attitude of concern and expressed it by taking care of you for a number of years. As in the case of other thresholds, emergent properties arose. Once we had love and appearing to deal with newborns. Here I will restrict my comments to humans, despite the dog in the picture. Humans became concerned, and at least even preoccupied, with whether or not people around us really love us, will they really care, will they really approve of what we do. Now, to discern whether people care, we to some extent rely on empirical observation. So as we look at the picture, the dog and the beautiful young girl are rubbing noses, Eskimo style, I guess. And that certainly is an outward sign of affection. However, it is common human experience that we also pick up vibes directly. We feel an atmosphere in a room. We come in and we feel the tension in the room or the anger. I must say that in my own classes, when it comes to exam time, the students usually gas me out. I come to the exam thinking while the students are taking the exam, I can get some work done. But the tension in the room is so incredible that I am absolutely unable to do anything useful. So, too, it is true that we pick up the vibes of love. You'll notice in the picture that the dog and the girl both have their eyes closed. They are not seeing each other. They are feeling the vibes, the psychological presence of love. Now, a major problem in science is we do not know how one brain picks up vibes from another. We know a lot about how brains see, how we hear, but this particular ability of human beings is as of yet not scientifically understood, at least to the best of my knowledge. If I had to make a guess, I would suggest the following: that the outward side of human thoughts and feelings are electronic impulses in the brain and the rest of the body. And I would hazard a guess that those electronic impulses produce some kind of larger electromagnetic field, and other brains, to some extent, are able to pick it up. Be that as it may, it's a matter of common experience that picking up vibes is simply something that human beings can do. Now, as human beings develop this ability to pick up vibes, people who are especially gifted in inward perception and who took the time and energy to hone that perception through such things as meditation, silence, and prayer, began to feel love from an unexpected source. They discovered you could have love in any time or place, even when you were alone, if you were sensitive enough and open enough and you cultivated silence, you could feel that you were loved. And such perceptive people then began to talk about receiving love from a spirit, from God, from some superhuman force, which was not restricted by time and space. In the slide, we have a picture of one of the great Native American leaders. He was a Sioux healer and visionary named Black Elk. In Professor Philip Novak's anthology, which he wrote for students in the religion department of this school, he teaches here, there is a short selection of something that Black Elk said. I quote, "Even in the very lightest breeze, you can hear the voice of the cottonwood tree. This we understand is its prayer, to the Great Spirit." The Great Spirit is apparently magnifying my voice. "All things and all beings pray to him continually in differing ways. For the Great Spirit is everywhere. He hears whatever is on our minds and hearts." But regardless of the kind offices of the Great Spirit, nature did not always appear to be loving. Of course, it was true that sometimes there were good crops and fair weather, but sometimes there were major natural crises. Now, before the rise of modern logical thinking, it was impossible to define a god or religion primarily in terms of love. Primitive humans believed that virtually everything was like them, that is, that it was alive and it had thoughts and feelings. Obviously, as you can see, this volcano is very much alive. It's even throwing things at people. And, of course, it is very angry. Otherwise, it would not be trying to kill us. Of course, volcanoes were only one of many things that were much more powerful than human beings, that were, if you like, gods or great spirits. And many of these things were also tremendously dangerous. There were earthquakes, there were floods, there were epidemics. Consequently, it appeared that the superhuman forces in the universe had attitudes which were not always kind and gentle. They could be arbitrary, they could be vindictive, they could be downright sadistic. Since these forces were so much greater than we are, people had to figure out how to keep them happy, especially how to keep them happy when we have somehow offended them. Consequently, in the primitive period, various sacred rites arose, some of which, from the perspective of subsequent times, seemed extremely cruel. In the slide, we have a picture of human sacrifice, in this case being offered in ancient Hawaii. Did I offend anyone? Is there anyone here from Hawaii? Well, then let me hasten to assure you that ancient human sacrifice arose independently in many different cultures. There was even human sacrifice in the culture from which the Bible comes. In ancient Israel, the great prophets of the Hebrew tradition railed against, screamed out against human sacrifice as a foul activity greatly displeasing to God. But the fact they had to say that is proof that human sacrifice was even being offered in their own culture. Okay? So, especially when there was a natural disaster, the question could not be avoided, who offended the gods? And if so, how severely must we punish that offender to keep the gods happy and to make them be kind to us again? This could result in the persecution of individuals who were said to be practicing witchcraft or some other evil thing, or whole peoples who are thought to be somehow less pleasing to God than we ourselves. Around the 5th century before the Common Era, in various places, largely independently, a new kind of religion arose, which scholars today call axial religion. It was a religion which stressed that the spiritual world was on the side of justice, and that religion should be analyzed logically. Okay? Now, this development was inspired by major changes in human civilization. Okay? Now, you are studying big histories, so you're much more on top of this than I am, but with your permission, I will give you a limited review of something which you understand much better than I do. The first human beings were hunter-gatherers. By necessity, they lived in small groups, perhaps of 70 or 80, and they were relatively egalitarian because all decisions were made face-to-face, and if anyone got too uppity, the rest of the group would put that person down. But with the agricultural revolution, when people began to plant and have domesticated animals, larger population centers arose. Eventually, we get to the great cities of the ancient world. Now, in such larger civilizations, it was necessary for someone to direct and others to follow. We began to have a hierarchical social system. And what that meant was that those on top lived extremely well, and those at the bottom suffered in misery. For example, we have independently arising in many different cultures the institution of slavery. Axial religion arose in part because certain morally sensitive people, maybe we should call them the first ethicists, were horrified at the conditions of the oppressed and could not believe that the gods or the spirits were in favor of this manifest exploitation of fellow human beings. And so in the name of those spirits, they said, this injustice must end. It offends the gods who rule the universe. About the same time, we have the discovery of logical thinking. Now, this happened independently in places like Greece and India, in the Middle East, and also in China. Okay? Now, discovery of logical thinking meant that you could analyze religion, ethics, and many other things. You could look at the consequences of ideas, and you could critique them. Prior to the evolution of logical thinking, all people could do in religion, or in science for that matter, was to tell stories, to tell myths. If you didn't like someone's story, you couldn't logically critique it. All you could do is tell a different story. But with the invention of logic and the concern about justice, then we come to have a whole different kind of religion. In the slide, we have a picture of the, or a statue rather, of the great Greek philosopher, one of the founders of Greek philosophy, Socrates. Socrates emphasized the importance of determining what you really know. He boasted, I assume ironically, that he was the one person who knew he didn't know anything. And when people claimed that they did know something, he would then ask them to spell out the implications, and then he would show that from the implications, they didn't really know that, or their implications were inconsistent. Socrates also was beginning a new, more rational approach to ethics and religion. It didn't turn out well for him. Often it doesn't turn out well for pioneers in general. The people who mattered in Athens, the citizens, thought he was raising entirely too many questions. He was bad-mouthing the gods, and they had Socrates executed. But he was the beginning of an effort to make religion more reasonable and more humane. And if time permitted, we could do a similar analysis of the ethics of the great Hebrew prophets about the same time. I mentioned them earlier in terms of their condemnation of human sacrifice. Or we could go to China, where Confucius and his followers taught that heaven is on the side of justice, and if an emperor oppresses his people, he loses the support of heaven, and it is ethical to kill the emperor. These were revolutionary ideas. On the basis of mystical experience, that is, on the basis of experiencing love from God, mystics, that is, people who were specialists in prayer and meditation and devoted their lives to becoming more sensitive to it, began to emphasize that the divine was wholly good, always loving, always merciful. In the slide, we have at least a modern artist's conception of Julian of Norwich, a 14th century English mystic. Now, in some ways, to me, and perhaps to you, she would seem hopelessly medieval, terribly out of date. Scholars think that, like many solitary religious women in that age, she was enclosed. That is, sealed up in a small cell, and all that she needed was passed through a window, and she devoted herself solely to prayer and giving spiritual advice through the window. Yike. But in other ways, she was centuries ahead of her time, and maybe even a little ahead of our time. She was the first woman ever to write a book in English. And in that book, she actually used feminine as well as masculine images for God and even for Jesus, despite the fact that Jesus was undeniably a male. She referred to God and even Jesus as our mother. For our present purposes, what is more important is on the basis of her visions, she insisted that God was wholly good, always loving, always merciful. She said she saw no anger in God. I quote from chapter 45 of her book. "I understood that sinners sometimes desire blame and wrath. Yet I could not see these two in God. In the slide, we have an illustration of one of her visions. She writes that she saw in her hand a small, fragile ball, no larger than a hazelnut. She wondered what it was and how something so small and weak could long endure. God, in response, informed her that what she was looking at was the entire universe, at least from God's perspective. Today we might say it was very shortly after the Big Bang, but anyway, she didn't know about that. And this tiny reality was only possible to endure because of God's constant love, only because God continually loved this fragile, small universe. Could it continue? But the claim that God was always loving and merciful was called into radical question by the arbitrariness of natural events. These were seen as acts of God, and I believe in law codes they are still called acts of God. As you can see from the dire black, the Black Death entered England around 1348. It killed perhaps 50% of the population of England, and indeed about the same percentage of the population of the European continent in general. Julia was born around 1342, so the Black Plague arrived when she was 6 years old, and since it continued for many years, it was perhaps the most important formative experience of her childhood. It is a testimony to the strength of Julian's religious experience that in the face of such a horror, she could maintain that God was always loving and merciful. Other people were not convinced, and they tried to placate God. There were many penances, many religious rites, but when God did not relent in the plague, more drastic means were tried. Many Christians resorted to slaughtering Jews. Whole communities of Jews in Europe were exterminated. Julian could say that God was loving and never got angry. Other people did not believe it. The rise of modern science, however, showed that natural events were due solely to natural causes. Isn't that creature cute? Wouldn't you like it as a pet? Well, if there's guilt by parentage, please realize it is the distant descendant of similar creatures which wiped out half of the population of Europe. It's always hard to know exactly how a disease worked 700 years ago, but the dominant scientific theory seems to be that the bacterium which caused the plague resided in the stomach of fleas, which in turn lived on rodents like this one, and from the rodents, the fleas then bit human beings and spread the disaster. Consequently, in many ways, modern science was a tremendous gift to religion. Modern science purified religion, and as someone who is professionally religious, as a teacher of religion, and indeed as an Episcopal priest, I have to admit we do not express as much gratitude to modern science as we probably should. Now, thanks to the discovery that natural catastrophes had natural causes, it was possible to affirm that God was wholly good, wholly loving, always merciful, just what the older mystics had always said. As a result, at least educated people today do not blame God for natural disasters. And religious people normally have no problem with saying that God is always loving. So, if there is an earthquake in 5 minutes and we have to evacuate this hall quickly, no one will ask which students offended God by texting when they were supposed to be listening to this lecture. And no one will go on to ask, and how many of them must we offer as human sacrifices to make God stop causing problems? So you can thank modern science for that. Meanwhile, let us go on to the evolution of science. Before the modern period, what we may loosely call ancient science, the study of the natural world, was done both by interior spiritual experience as well as by looking at things, by empirical observation. We may note in passing, especially those who hate mathematics, actually, who here hates mathematics? Lots of people. That mathematics is really a remnant of the older point of view. It's an exercise in pure logic. It does not depend on empirical observation. You make pure definitions about numbers and lines and circles, and then you deduce things logically, which must be true. Now, as I said, prior to modern times, science was done as much by spiritual intuition as by empirical observation. In the slide, we see a picture of the universe as it was thought to exist before Copernicus discovered that the Earth revolved around the sun. Now, what's important about this is that the universe here is not so much as we see it, but as people thought ideally it had to be, because this was the perfect ideal. All the heavenly bodies rotate in perfect circles. Okay? They are made, you can't see this, but it's true, they are made of a much purer matter than anything on Earth. They are made of celestial material. The heavens have no flaw, they are perfect, and they never change. Since ancient people and medieval people noticed that if you don't keep pushing something, it tends to slow down, they asked the question, why do the eternal heavens not grind to a halt? And they said, well, somebody has to be up there pedaling. So then we have the unmoved mover, the thing that keeps the engine going. And at least for Christian Europe, the unmoved mover was God himself. He's pedaling to keep the universe from grinding to a halt. And of course, somewhere up there in the misty beyond are the souls of the righteous, those who have gone to heaven after leading good lives on earth. Clearly, this universe is not primarily based on observation. It is based rather on ethical values, on religious insights, on intuitive senses of how things ought to be. But then science focused more and more on observation, on empirical data. In the slide, we have a picture, or at least a modern artist's conception, of a scientist whom some people say was the founder of modern science, the great physicist and astronomer Galileo. He was a pioneer in empiricism. He was the first person to use a telescope to look at how the heavenly bodies actually were. Galileo discovered that, of course, the heavens were not perfect. They were not unchanging. The sun had spots on it sometimes. The moon had mountains. A star could explode into a nova and then disappear altogether. In time, science largely abandoned ethics or inner spiritual experience as evidence for material reality. Instead, it focused more and more on what could be observed by the senses. And the senses now were incredibly strengthened through all kinds of technology. Microscopes, x-rays, radio telescopes, all kinds of things. One consequence, then, was science did not and could not any longer comment much on the spiritual or even on the ethical, what is right and wrong. It could only comment on the natural world. At most, it might be able to observe the outer signs of the spiritual. So if someone is meditating, you can hook up an electronic device and look at how their brain waves change, but you cannot judge the meditation itself. Okay? Now, as science became more and more powerful, it was clear that that power could be used as easily for evil as good. Therefore, science raised ever more urgent ethical questions, which could not be resolved on any scientific basis. Perhaps the greatest theoretical achievement of science in the first half of the 20th century was a discovery that mass, the material things, and energy, matter and energy, are forms of the same thing. And under the right conditions, you could change mass into energy using the formula mass equals energy times the speed of light squared. Then, the technologists discovered that you could do this to produce enormous amounts of energy. And in the picture, you see one of the first results of this tremendous technological and scientific breakthrough. Okay? Of course, what you're looking at is Hiroshima after the United States dropped the first atomic bomb. As science also went on to try to explain how the mind worked, it began to say, well, we have to discover how the mind works in terms of natural causation. What's the chemistry of the brain? What are the electric impulses that nerves send, and so forth? But with that effort to reduce the brain once again to simply a natural system in which everything is caused by physical reaction, there arose a tremendous philosophical problem. And that is, if the way that we think is itself merely determined by things like chemistry, how do we know that our thought is valid? If, for example, our ethical values are simply a product of evolutionary contingency, things that happen to us as a species 100,000 years ago, why should we take our ethical thinking at all seriously? Maybe it is simply an accident of history and has no validity at all. But at least, it did seem to continue that science could explain the natural world. It may not be able to defend ethics, but at least science did not have to appeal to the spiritual, to God, to some transcendent reality. And so a famous slogan from the 19th century is, at least for science, God is an unnecessary hypothesis. This was attributed to Pierre-Simon Laplace, one of the greatest scientists in history, but modern scholars think that he never actually said that. But the fact that this great scientist was always quoted as having said that showed the power and the pervasiveness of this idea that the spiritual and the religious had no place in scientific explanation. Everything could be explained in terms of impersonal physical laws. But recently, naturalistic explanations of the most basic phenomena of the universe have had to postulate enormous coincidences and deal with other grave difficulties. Here I will only confine myself to four illustrations. The first is the fine-tuning of the Big Bang and the basic physical laws of our universe. As scientists have gotten more information about the Big Bang and the basic laws of the universe, they have been astonished at how narrow the framework is in which life can arise. So let me confine myself to a few examples. If 1 second after the Big Bang, the force of the explosion had been stronger or weaker by 1 × 10⁻¹⁵, that's decimal point, followed by 14 zeros, followed by a 1, life could not have emerged. Roger Penrose, or rather Sir Roger Penrose, he was knighted for his tremendous contributions to astronomy, calculated that for the universe to have enough low entropy to produce 100 billion galaxies, that is, a universe where there'd be enough planets that at least on one of them life would surely arise, the possibility of that, he claims, is 10⁻¹³. That is 1 followed by 10⁻²⁰ zeros. If you typed out that number in a single column, it would literally reach to the stars. Now let's have an illustration which is not quite so drastic. If a strong atomic force, what holds atoms together, were 1/250th different, life would be impossible. If the force of gravity were changed by only 3 × 10⁻³⁷, that's point, followed by 36 zeros and a 3, there could be no life. Did life simply arise as an incredible coincidence? Then there's the problem of Wallace's conundrum. Wallace, incidentally, was one of the early champions of evolution. He raised the question of why higher intellectual abilities, like the ability to do mathematics, or maybe higher humanistic abilities and spiritual abilities, the ability to do logic or the ability to meditate, why were they naturally selected, as they surely were, when they did not help people kill the saber-toothed tiger? I forgot to put that on. Okay. Clearly, most of what we use at Dominican University did not help people who were hunter-gatherers. Why do we have all those abilities? Why were they selected? And of course, science depends totally on those abilities, which gave no survival advantage. And then once again, the issue arises. If those abilities were simply arbitrarily determined by evolution, odd circumstances at a particular time, can we really believe in them? Can we really trust them? Incidentally, Charles Darwin worried about that. How can we believe our thinking is valid if it was simply arbitrarily determined by the accidents of evolution. Now we come to something which has only happened in recent years, and that is the pervasiveness, extreme number of near-death, out-of-body experiences. Before the rise of very recent medical technology, if you were very close to death, you almost always died. But thanks to magnificent machines, to say nothing of the tremendous skills of Dominican University nursing graduates, people who are clinically dead are frequently now revived. By clinically dead, I mean at least their heart has stopped beating, but often also that their brain waves are flat. Many, many people, now at least thousands, maybe millions, have reported that as they were on the threshold of death, they left their bodies. They looked down and saw the physicians desperately trying to do something. They felt drawn through some kind of tunnel, some kind of tube or space. At the other end of it, they met their deceased friends and relatives who were delighted to see them. They were in a place of peace and love. Then they were interviewed by what they call a being of light, who showed them their past life. And these near-dead people were thrilled with the good deeds they had done and embarrassed about the bad things they had done. Then, of course, nurses and doctors working furiously get the body going again, and the people feel themselves pulled back into their body. Now, those who debunk these experiences and feel they have no meaning to them suggest that these are hallucinations. They are merely produced by a dying brain. But how a dying brain could produce coherent experiences, which survivors believe are not only real, but give them a sense of the total meaning of life, we are not told. In passing, we must also remind ourselves of a philosophic problem which has haunted humanity for really thousands of years now, and that is the question of how we distinguish reality from what we dream. The answer, if there is an answer, is when we wake up, we have a gut-level feeling that what we're now experiencing is more real than a dream, and we realize that the dreams themselves were not coherent. But these near-death, out-of-body experiences are coherent, and the people who have them have the gut-level feeling that this experience was even more real than what we call everyday reality. My last illustration of the present situation is how now scientists so often rely on beauty as a basis for formulating new hypotheses. In fields like cosmology, often there isn't a great deal of solid empirical data, and so people are fiddling around with things like higher mathematics, and some scientists will say things like, this math is so beautiful, it must be true. And the strange thing is that more often than not, it turns out to be true when further empirical evidence becomes available. If the universe is only a product of endless coincidences and accidents, why should beauty be a guideline for discovering what is scientifically true? Now, some scientists have continued to insist that there must be naturalistic explanations for everything, for what appears to be the fine tuning of the Big Bang and scientific laws for out of body near death experiences and so forth. But the explanations which are offered often seem to have no empirical basis and seem to be wild speculations. let's talk about the fine tuning of the Big Bang. Skeptics say there's no fine tuning of the Big Bang. It's like getting a hand in poker or in bridge. You get a hand which is mathematically tremendously unlikely, but everyone's hand is like that. You may never see those same cards again, but because there are so many possible deals, you just got the one you got. So here, the best explanation for why the universe seems to be so carefully tuned for life. The reason it's not purposeful is because we live in only one of a zillion universes in the universe. Well, we'll call them cosmic systems. Okay? So there are zillions of cosmic systems, each of which have a different set of scientific laws. And we just happen to be in the one which has those precise laws which make life possible. But one must reply, we've never seen any of these cosmic systems, universes, if you like. And the number of them you have to have is incomprehensibly large. So if our fine tuning is only accidental, then we must be one out of 10 to around 160th universes. That's one, followed by approximately 160 zeros. Other scientists have concluded that for some basic things, one has to have a religious explanation. That you can only go so far with postulating more and more coincidences. At some point, you have to pull the plug and say, this can't be accidental. There must be something analogous to a creator. Robert Jastrow was a major figure in the National Space Administration, has a PhD and teaches physics and all of that. He wrote a book, and in that book he had a quote which has now become famous. He himself is an agnostic, at least he claims to be. He doesn't know if there's a God or not, but he, as a scientist, realizes that there are problems with saying we don't know there is a God. Here is the famous quote. For the scientist who has lived by his faith in the power of reason, the story ends like a bad dream. He has scaled the mountains of ignorance. He is about to conquer the highest peak. As he pulls himself over the final rock, he is greeted by a band of theologians who have been sitting there for centuries. I love that quote because I happen to be a theologian, someone whose job is to think about spiritual and divine realities. Okay. That is the end of the story, or rather now it becomes your story. There's no such thing as pure objectivity. And I certainly do not claim to be purely objective myself. But I at least hope that everything that I have said is objectively accurate, whether or not I have slanted it through my own religious perspective. Okay? So now your generation must take up the discussion of love, religion, and science. But as someone who is soon to retire from Dominican, here is my own legacy to you. Here is what I would like you to consider. First, we certainly have to affirm all the proven discoveries of science. The time is long past when religion had the right to say, it can't be so because the Bible says different, or because my grandparents taught me in religion class something else. So we have to affirm all that science has genuinely shown. But I would argue we must also affirm what is, after all, only common experience, that our brains do have the possibility of picking up the vibes of other brains, that we are able, by some process we do not yet understand, to directly experience the feelings of others. And we need to affirm the religious discovery, proven again and again by those who sharpen their perception through meditation and prayer, that there is a cosmic love. There is a love which is available in all times and all places, even when we are alone. And we must hypothesize that that love also has an energy. We feel energized by the love of others. And if there is an energy, it probably is not confined to human beings, but can affect other things as well. Then I would say, why don't we work on the hypothesis that this cosmic love is one, but only one, factor in the evolution of the universe, beginning with the Big Bang and going through the various stages of cosmic evolution and then the evolution of life. That some things are scientific laws and some things are influenced by cosmic love, and what has happened is some combination of the two. And then instead of seeing science and religion as totally separate disciplines, let alone as hostile disciplines, may I suggest it might be possible to see science and religion as partners in explaining the totality of reality, whether it is what's out there or what goes on in our own minds and hearts. Thank you very much.